Let's go ahead and open our Bibles to 2 Kings chapter 20, verse 20. Yesterday, we finished the last wisdom book of the five wisdom books in our scripture. That was the book of Ecclesiastes, which I believed was written by King Hezekiah as he was grappling with the fact that his life was drawing to an end. And he wanted to make sense of life and death. And you know the conclusion he came to. He said that we should all fear God and keep his commandments, because we will all answer to him for what we've done in our life. Well, Hezekiah has finished his 15 extra years, and it is time for him to give an account now to God for what he did with his life. And so 2 Kings chapter 20, verse 20 says, "The rest of the deeds of Hezekiah, and all his might, and how he made the pool and the conduit, and brought water into the city, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah?" And so those were some of the highlights that we went over during his life, how he made sure that the pool of Siloam had water supplied to it from the Gihon Spring. And he did this by putting in what we call today the Hezekiah Tunnel. And so the water from the Gihon no longer spills out into the Kidron Valley. It goes down to the Pool of Siloam, all of it inside the walls of ancient Jerusalem. And Hezekiah was the one that is famous for that. We are reminded over in the Chronicles parallel here, 2 Chronicles 33 is where this is at, that the things that he did were also written in the vision of Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz. And so Isaiah is also one of the biographers, the spiritual biographers of Hezekiah's time. And we've been reading some of Hezekiah's events from the book of Isaiah. Now, 2 Kings 20, 21 says, "Hezekiah slept with his fathers." That's a euphemism for he passed away, just like everyone else before him. "And Manasseh, his son, reigned in his place." More about him in just a moment. 2 Chronicles 32, 33 says, "Hezekiah slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the upper part of the tombs of the sons of David," which I believe is on the east side of the old city of David, not too far away from where the Gihon Spring would be. All Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem did him honor at his death. We know from another passage that he was the greatest of all the kings to reign over Judah at Jerusalem. So he is an honorable man, and he receives an honorable burial. And then Manasseh, his son, reigned in his place. Let's return back to our baseline of 2 Kings 21. Manasseh was 12 years old when he began to reign. Now, what does that tell us? That tells us that Manasseh was born after Hezekiah was granted his additional 15 years. And so he is a son of the bonus period. And some people have criticized that because of Manasseh being the worst of the kings that ever reigned at Jerusalem. But I like to point out that the Chronicles also records that Manasseh repented of those sinful things and was forgiven by God. And so even though he is listed as the worst king, he ends up being a redeemed king, and I anticipate meeting him one of these days in eternity. Let's continue a little bit more about him. He reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. That means he was the longest reigning king in the nation of Israel. And even though he was 12 years of age when he came to power, he no doubt was surrounded in those earlier years by some of Hezekiah's wise advisors and counselors. And so he may have restrained himself at the very beginning, but he's going to blow up into sin as he moves forward in his life. And by the way, the year that we're talking about here, I think, is 698 BC. That's my chronology for when Hezekiah died and Manasseh became the king of Judah. His mother's name was Hephzibah, and we don't know really anything about her other than her name. Now comes the assessment, because these things are written down by prophets who lived probably during the later reign of King Hezekiah and recorded them for the benefit of posterity. Verse 2, he did what was evil in the sight of He Who Is, according to the despicable practices of the nations whom He Who Is drove out before the people of Israel. Now think about this. They have been in the land at this time 700 plus years. So that's how long it's been since Joshua came in to the land and drove out the first bunch of the Amorites and the Canaanites. But we know that the history was that the Canaanites came back, and it was a constant struggle back and forth with these false religious practices that the Israelis sometimes gave into and other times got rid of. Now, Hezekiah had purged the land. That's one of the reasons he is counted as the greatest king of the Judean kingdom and of all of Israel itself. But here is his son. Once he gets into power, once he starts making decisions for himself, what does he do? He decides to go the Canaanite way, the Amorite way. And so verse 3 reports that he rebuilt the high places that Hezekiah, his father, had destroyed. So he reverses Hezekiah's purge. He erected altars for Baal and made an Asherah, as Ahab, king of Israel, had done, and worshipped all the host of heaven and served them. So Baal was the thunder and lightning god of the Canaanites. He's now being worshipped by Manasseh. Asherah was Baal's cohort, or his consort, his wife, and she was the queen of heaven. She was the fertility goddess. She's worshipped by wood, by a tree of some sort, or perhaps a totem pole. So he's worshipping her as well. But he doesn't just stop with him. He's also brought in the plethora of other gods and goddesses that were part of the Middle Eastern, population of idols. And so he's bringing them into play in his kingdom. Over time, verse 4 says, he built altars in the house of He Who Is, of which He Who Is, it said, in Jerusalem will I put my name. So he's not just simply doing like Solomon did. Solomon, in his bad choices, allowed worship altars and temples to be built over on the Mount of Olives, outside the city limits of the holy city. This guy, Manasseh, is building these altars in the city of Jerusalem itself, where they'd been gotten rid of by his dad. And he's also putting them back in the temple complex, the very house of God, where his father had kicked them out before. Verse 5, he built altars for all the host of heaven in the two courts of the house of He Who Is. The two courts that we're talking about, it would be the closest court to the shrine building. That's where the priests do all their work. And then the assembly court, which at this time I think was just out in front to the east, where the people would come and meet with the priests with sacrifices and make arrangements for things to be done on their behalf. So he's putting these pagan altars in both the most sacred courtyard and in the more public courtyard. And then comes a really shocking thing. Verse number 6 says, and he burned his sons, plural, as an offering. Now, in the parallel from 2 Chronicles 33, it's very clear that he burned his son, and there it uses a singular. He burned his son to in the valley of the son of Hinnom. So, in the place to the southeast of the oldest part of the city of Jerusalem, which will eventually be known as Hell, Gehenna. It'll be cleansed and then defaced by a later king, and it'll end up becoming a garbage dump. But this is the worship of Chemosh Molech that had started first with the Ammonites and the Moabites in commemoration of how they started as a people. If you don't remember, that's the story of Lot, and where when he was in a cave and wouldn't let his daughters have any contact with the outside world, they got him drunk and got pregnant by him and had children. Had a boy, one of them had a boy that they named Moab, which means from daddy. And the other one had a baby boy that she called Ben-Ami, which means son of my people or son of my family. And so they kind of celebrated the continuation of their genome by, from time to time, getting drunk, having sex, and from that pregnancy, those babies became future sacrifices to the god of destruction, the god that destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, of course, we know that was the true and living God, but they were worshiping a twisted version of him. Molech, that means king. Chemosh means destroyer. And so the god of Moab, the god of Ammon, also started being worshipped by the Canaanites. And now here we have an Israeli king, a Judah king, who is actually participating in that pagan ceremony of getting drunk, causing a woman to get pregnant, and then taking that little baby and murdering him as a sacrifice to this pagan deity. So he didn't do it just once. He did it multiple times. Verse 6 in our 2 Kings 21 passage says, and he used fortune-telling, which means trying to read omens and signs to tell about the future, and omens, and he dealt with mediums and with wizards. The mediums and wizards are people who were able to tap into the spirit world. Sometimes they claim that they could contact the dead, but I've told you before, I believe that they were just simply in contact with the demonic beings, the fallen angels, that were acting as con men, and that these were mechanisms by which the demonic world impacted the physical world. So he's voluntarily getting into contact with Satan's domain. It says here, he did much evil in the sight of he who is, provoking him to anger. So God is going to have to come down on him. The carved image of Asherah that he had made, he set in the house of which he who is said to David and to Solomon his son, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I've chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever, and I will not cause the feet of Israel to wander any more out of the land that I gave to their fathers, if only they will be careful to do according to all that I've commanded them and according to all that the law that my servant Moses commanded them. But they did not listen. And Manasseh led them astray to do more evil than the nations had done, whom he who is destroyed before the people of Israel. So the writer of 2 Kings engages in some spiritual commentary here to say, look, this guy was so evil that he put an Asherah worship object in the temple complex itself, this thing of shame. And this place was only supposed to be used for worship with God himself. And God had promised when he said, make this building for me, that if they would just keep to his covenant, he would never make them leave the land. But the author of 2 Kings, just like the author of 2 Chronicles, is building up to the ultimate end of this story, in that God will have enough of this, and he will bring in the Babylonians, and he will destroy the temple, and he will destroy Jerusalem through their hands. He wants to keep his promise, but they won't let him because they won't live up to the terms of that promise, and that is to remain only his people and not the people of other gods and goddesses. So Manasseh is the agent through which all of that horrible stuff took place, and God's going to have to respond to it. Verse number 10. He who is said by his servants, the prophets. So here we come, a bunch of messengers in the time of Manasseh. Now, Isaiah would have still been alive when Hezekiah died and Manasseh came to power. And he probably was one of the first to preach against the evils of Manasseh. And the tradition is that Isaiah was killed, executed by Manasseh. The story, which it's hard to pin down how accurate it is, was that he was in a tree. He was in a hollow log and was sawn in half. And the book of Hebrews does mention somebody as a prophet that was sawn in half. And it's very widely believed that it was probably a reference to that story about what Manasseh did to Isaiah. But Isaiah wasn't the only prophet that was speaking against Manasseh. It's multiple messengers. So here's what they're saying, starting in verse number 11. Because Manasseh, king of Judah, has committed these abominations and has done things more evil than all that the Amorites did who were before him, and has made Judah also to sin with his idols. So it's not just him going bad. He's actually bringing the whole place down with him. And that is shocking, because we know, again, that Hezekiah was the greatest of all the kings of Judah. And he lifted the people up with him. And here, the moment he's dead, his son becomes the worst of the kings, and he drags the people down with him. And so therefore, verse 12, thus says he who is the God of Israel, behold, I am bringing upon Jerusalem and Judah such disaster that the ears of everyone who hears of it will tingle. So it's going to make their ears burn and feel bad when they're hearing all the horrible things that's going to happen to Jerusalem and to the people. And it's true. It was an atrocious situation with the judgment of God against Jerusalem and the people of Judah in the days of the Babylonians. Verse 13, "And I will stretch over Jerusalem the measuring line of Samaria and the plumb line of Ahab." And this is a reference back to other prophetic passages, that when God was judging the northern kingdom, he said that he was going to stretch out this measuring line, you know, to check the horizontal alignment of structures. And because they weren't in alignment, he was going to bring down Samaria. And then a plumb line is to check the vertical alignment of construction. And because they were not in plumb, the house of Ahab, that is the northern kingdom, was also going to be destroyed. So now God is saying, I'm going to take those same standards of judgment and I'm going to line them up against Jerusalem. And it's going to show that Jerusalem is out of kilter and the people are out of whack. And because of that, I'm going to bring judgment, just as I said back in the days of Moses, the first prophet. I will wipe Jerusalem as one wipes a dish, wiping it and turning it upside down. So here's the idea of somebody doing dishes. You know, you got a dirty dish and you scrub it out and wipe it clean and then you turn it upside down empty. And that's what's going to happen to Jerusalem. It's going to be so full of sin that God's going to come down in judgment and wipe it clean of the entire population. And he's going to empty it and turn it over, and it won't be used for a while. Verse 14, "And I will forsake the remnant of my heritage and give them into the hand of their enemies." Now, when he says remnant of his heritage, he's talking about the fact that northern Israel's already gone into exile because of their sin. Judah is what's left of the Israeli people. They're the remnant that's also now going to go into the hand of their enemies. "And they shall become prey and a spoil to all their enemies, because they've done what is evil in my sight and have provoked me to anger since the day their fathers came out of Egypt, even to this day." So this is not a new thing. It's been going on for a long time. The back and forth, fighting against God, biting the hand that was feeding them. And so God's saying, I've had enough. Judgment is going to fall. Verse 16, "Moreover, Manasseh shed very much innocent blood till he had filled Jerusalem from one end to another, besides the sin that he made Judah to sin, so that what they did was evil in the sight of he who is." So everything's falling apart in the kingdom of Judah because it starts at the top. The top is rotten with Manasseh, and everybody underneath him is kind of falling into the same sort of sinful behavior. And so judgment is on its way, and we'll see that talked about a lot more in the prophecies that come hereafter. Now, we've got one last thing that I want to mention that happens historically right around this time we kind of skipped over earlier. And that would be in 2 Kings 19:37, I believe. And this is what happened with one of the kings of the Assyrians that caused trouble in the time of Hezekiah. And it was said that he was going to come to a bad end. And we need to find out how that happened. So this is going to happen in 681 BC, which is during the reign of Manasseh. 2 Kings 19:37, "And as he," this would be Sennacherib, "as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch his god, Adrimelech and Sherezer, his sons, struck him down with a sword and escaped into the land of Ararat. So he's assassinated by some of his own people. And then he's replaced. Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his place. And so all of that happened during the first part of King Manasseh's reign as the most unrighteous king that had ever ruled at Jerusalem. Now, next week, we're going to come back and we're going to take a little detour in a book that represents prophecies that happened right around this same time period. We're talking about the 7th century BC, the beginning of the 7th century BC. And that's going to be the book of Nahum, if you'd like to go ahead and get it. We know that it must have been written not too long after the Assyrian destruction of Thebes in 663 BC, but it's still going to happen many years, several decades before the Assyrian capital of Nineveh was destroyed in 612. So have a great weekend, have a great Lord's Day, and make sure that you keep going right back into God's Word.